Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Chris Sutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Hi, Nick. Terrence, doing well, thank you. 2025 continues to deliver all-time greatest hits of geopolitical change, so lots for us to get into today.
Indeed. We'll get into that towards the end of the show. But Chris, I must admonish you for not matching my energy here. You know, I'm drinking all this coffee so that I can bring some energy. So I want to see more energy. We're also joined today with Mr. Terrence Corrigan. Terrence, how are you? Are you gonna match my energy?
Yeah, look, this is a world in which you have a bad night's sleep. Wake up, World War III started, and I'm not even wearing my collared shirt. I'm being chavvy today. Which probably that's too late for me, but never mind. I can groove with the young'uns. I suppose if I'm saying groove, yeah.
This is not a good sign of the ability to groove with the young'uns.
Well, but you anyway. Know, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys died. I was very sad. That also dates me.
Yes, no, unfortunately it does a bit. Right, so before we go on to discuss matters international, let us do a quick review of what exactly has been going on at home. Well, as of tomorrow, it'll be exactly 1 year since President Cyril Ramaphosa was elected for his second term as president of the country with the help of votes from the Democratic Alliance as well as a number of other parties, marking the official start of the government of national unity, sort of. The further negotiations would continue. I believe that a year ago today, they were still hammering out some of the final details on that statement of intent, which hasn't really been honored. So I guess let's get right into where we think the GNU is a year on. I think that it's in a very interesting place, politically speaking. I think in terms of governance, you know, you're seeing almost every single one of the party's ministries kind of operating in silos, right? You see the DA ministry is kind of doing their own thing as much as possible over here, and the ANC ministry is doing their thing over here. And there is some occasional sort of attempts at crossover, but really these two parties are acting largely like they're different governments inhabiting the same union buildings. The DA and ANC have obviously had these very vicious fights over the Bella Bill, over the signing of the Expropriation Act, over NHI, and most impactfully, over the budget, where eventually the ANC was forced to cave on the issue of the VAT hike. Lots of harsh words have been exchanged, but the interesting thing is that the GNU still hangs on despite everything. And I think that's a testament to the fact that South African voters in general, particularly ANC and DA voters, are actually pretty keen on the GNU sticking around. They think it's a good idea, at least conceptually, even if the execution hasn't been amazing. So, Terrence, let me begin with you. Do you agree, firstly, with my summary of how the Government of National Unity has been sort of working politically? And what do you make of it? Who do you think are performing well in their governance roles? Who do you think is doing badly? Is there any prospect for things to get better in the GNU?
Well, look, I think there's a couple of things. It's a sort of new and unfamiliar experience. I don't think, even until the results came in, the ANC was ever expecting that it would ever face this moment, because it has this kind of like right to rule. And all of a sudden, it didn't. I do think for the ANC, though, and I think this has been adequately understood by the commentariat, that where else is it going to go? You know, maybe if you're Paul Mashatile or Banyaza Lesufi, you want to go to the EFF. I think for most of the ANC, they know the EFF will eat them alive. Similar thing with MK. Well, polling evidence suggests that it is a popular option. The idea that the ANC somehow cares and the DA is somehow competent, and you put these together and you can get caring and competent. But yeah, I think that Tony Leon's book has a couple of interesting comments on this. The way that the way that that the executive is structured in South Africa, and a number of people have made this over the years, the sort of powers that have been vested in the presidency over the years, has removed a great deal of power that ministers should rightfully have had, or at least would have diffused things. And that's enabled President Ramaphosa to go on and sort of carry on many, many respects, as though nothing has changed. But do I see anything changing? Not really. And I think that what we saw with the announcement of the national dialogue, that kind of becomes the next big thing. You know, we had the GNU phase, like we had the New Dawn phase, then we had the Mandate Horizon phase, then we had the post-COVID phase, and this is the next one. You know, we can't really do anything, and more importantly, we can't be held account for anything, because we're waiting for this process. When that unfolds, you know, it's going to blow your socks off with what's going to be there. And I've heard, you know, I'm along with having enjoyed the Beach Boys when the Beach Boys were a thing, I can also say that I've been around through the New South Africa to watch these fads come and go. I remember when the RDP was this wonderful plan that was going to revolutionize the country, and I remember Gear, and I remember the NDP. And I remember one big name celebrity academic saying in a debate that, well, you know, all the cynicism, we're about to start rolling out the NDP, and this is really going to resolve most of these issues. Does anyone even remember it?
So
do I expect much? Well, look, I mean, I suppose the good thing is it could be worse. Now, that's a low bar, but when your bar is a South African one, it's generally not one that one needs to exert oneself to jump over.
Mm-hmm. No, we are sort of in a very weird place where we're beginning to see the ANC reach the sort of limits of its new position in parliament. I've heard of a couple of relatively minor votes recently where the ANC was on the verge of losing, so withdrew items or wasn't able to do something it wanted to do because it knew it was going to lose. Of course, the budget was a great example of that. But, you know, at the end of that budget process, while I think the final budget was certainly vastly improved over the initial budget proposed, it still wasn't great. It still, I think, didn't really focus on some of the key issues. It still sort of drove up the debt problem, that kind of thing. So, I don't know, Chris, where do you think we are and where do you think this is headed? I suspect that things will kind of quietly trundle along for a bit more. You know, there'll be this national dialogue, which will be a lot of talk about nothing. And then we're going to get to the local government elections. And the closer we get to that, the more hostile it's going to be inside the GNU. What do you make of all this?
So by their own metrics, those being growth and unemployment, the GNU has failed within the last 12 months on improving on those two metrics. So in the first quarter of this year, growth down. And then based on the latest data we have available, growth isn't likely to breach far above 1% for the remaining quarters of this year. If you take that in a context of a growing population between 1.4-1.6% per year, South Africans then become poorer over time, at least based on if you use real GDP per capita. If you talk about shifting policies, I think largely the ANC has continued its route. There has been pushback in small areas here and there, and we saw it probably most with the budget. So when it comes to actual government spending on policy priorities, maybe then you can say, okay, the GNU has been good in that particular, in isolation and in the context of what a sort of national coalition could have looked like if some other parties had gone into a national coalition with the ANC. If we talk about the sort of longevity of the GNU, I think for now it remains the best option for most of the parties, including the ANC and the DA, but that doesn't mean it's good in and of itself, that it's shifting things that South Africa needs in terms of policy and legislative changes. Just maybe a sort of last thought or a last point. The ANC, we see in polling by the Institute, by other organizations, support for the ANC continuing to decline. Whether they take that signal then to use the fact that there are now energy in you and to internally actually reform for once and pursue a different route, that remains up to them. We haven't seen evidence to believe that. So it would be naive and to put all of one's hopes in that. From a sentiment point of view, I don't want to underestimate the benefit of the GNU. The JSE All Share is up around 23, 24% in the last year. So if you are, if that's your view on the economy of South Africa, things are doing a lot better than they have been for the last 5 to 10 years, but it's not changes in the sort of real economy. So in fixed investment, in manufacturing and mining, in construction, those kinds of things, especially those industries and sectors that are more easier for labor to be absorbed and for more jobs to be created. So, yeah, I think from a sentiment and narrative point of view, the GNU has been good, but it hasn't meaningfully, I think, either put in place the sort of changes that you would then see positive long-term impact in South Africans' lives or in just the immediate short-term shifting things on the growth and unemployment front.
It has been remarkable to me how sort of moribund the ANC has been. It's just really, really struggled to make any kind of change whatsoever to its direction. I mean, you could, I guess, say that the decision to go into an alliance with the DA and the Freedom Front Plus and IFP was a better, you know, was an indication that the ANC had changed somewhat than simply shacking up with the EFF and MK. Although, you know, even then, there's some talk that part of this wasn't even necessarily the ANC's first instinct, that the EFF and MK just had such incoherent and outrageous demands off the bat that it sort of scuppered anything. I'm not sure entirely what the truth is there, but it's sort of the ANC is seeing kind of the boat leaking on all sides, right? And its approach has been, well, it seems, and I think this was something that I can't remember who said it, but that the ANC appears to be under the impression that the only threat it faces is from MK and the EFF. And therefore, in order to win back those voters, it needs to double down on all the craziest populist policies. It needs to make sure that it's, you know, expropriating all the land and creating all the NHIs and, you know, setting all the racial quotas in every industry, whatever. But I think that's a misreading of the situation. I think a lot of people who vote for the EFF and MK aren't necessarily voting for it because of its kind of policy proposals per se. They're voting for it because a lot of South African voters often kind of have this attitude of backing the strong horse. They see these parties as being very assertive and very aggressive. And you know, they're sort of around figures who are well known by many South Africans. They have very famous leaders. And so I think dissatisfaction with the way the country is going is actually driving support for the EFF and MK, not necessarily growing support for those policies, which means that if the ANC actually wanted to reduce support for those parties, they'd need to grow the economy, because then people would have less reason to abandon the ANC. And they're not going to grow the economy by tripling down on all the bad ideas. Terence, do you agree with that? What do you make of what I just said? Sorry, you're muted, sir. There you go. You're unmuted.
I think that something that's underappreciated about our politics is the extent to which ideology is determinative. We have a political class. The DA is an exception to some extent, although it's there too. That is entirely dominated by people who've never known a life outside politics, and for some, it goes back to, you know, their childhoods. And, you know, as I say, when all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look suspiciously like a nail. The ironic thing is that I think many of the kind of pet projects, the transformative stuff that speaks to people's esteem, is far more attractive to a middle-class constituency than it is to, you know, your historical working class, you know, poor, or as Aesop Ahad once said, the lumpen proletariat, which is quite a way to talk about people who vote for you, but never mind. People who want social mobility, who, you know, want a steady job and a nice house or whatever, are probably a lot less concerned about the complexion of their neighborhood or whether the law firm that they consult to deal with their defamation claims, you know, is sufficiently representative of the of the population. But then again, you know, I recall that there was a there's an ANC I think the centenary celebration a couple of years ago, where there was this crowd there, and the like. The Mandarins brought out this cake, which they cut to celebration. And I think it was Gwede Mantashe who said, "Don't worry, we'll eat the cake for you." Well, you know, that's emblematic, isn't it? But no,
Anti-economic policy in a sentence.
I don't think the ANC can change. You know, it's like someone who just smokes too much crystal meth, or, you know, someone who just, you know, has this insane desire to gamble, or to, you know, go with pros, or whatever, you know, whatever your kink or your vice is, you got to do it because you got to do it.
Mm-hmm. So, it does indeed seem so.
I think basically you know you have to wait for some major shift, and I'm not sure what that will be. Cyril Ramaphosa was not it. Sorry to say.
You know, there was a diplomat, and it was a completely different context to this, but he used the phrase, if this doesn't wake the patient up, then we can declare the patient dead. And I think one gets that feeling from the ANC more. It's like you sort of keep saying, well, they need to do something different, or else they're going to lose power. Well, I mean, at this rate, it doesn't really seem like they're in any attitude to lose power. I don't know. You know, politics does have a habit of
it's kind of exciting. Like, forget Hammer. Well, actually, no, take Hammer. I'm just going to belt the patient on the head a few times, cave it in, and if that doesn't wake him up, he's probably dead, you know. But all I have is the hammer.
Yeah. You
know, I'm not going to tickle his feet or anything like that. I've got a hammer, and I'm going to use it.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to our next topic, and I'll come to you on this one, Chris. We've seen this major trade conflict across the world between the United States and China. The US has imposed huge tariffs on countries all across the planet. And China is seeking to cast itself as the sort of responsible guardian of the global trade order or something like that. It looks like AGOA has pretty much fallen apart now with Donald Trump's tariffs leveled against most African countries. And it seems now that China is sensing an opportunity for itself to increase its influence and its trade. With trade diminishing with the United States, China is looking for other markets to sell its stuff to. And Africa seems to be one of the places that it's targeting. President Xi Jinping has announced that all African countries, with the exception of Eswatini, because Eswatini recognizes Taiwan, not China, will be accorded zero tariff treatments for 100% tariff lines, according to a letter which was issued to foreign ministers from the African continent. This is all part of just larger Chinese efforts to, I think, kind of woo African markets over to their side. Africa is going to continue to increase in terms of its sort of share of the global population in the coming decades, unless something radical changes. So Africa's markets will grow larger. And I think this is something that China might be betting on in terms of its future export opportunities. Chris, what do you make of this? I mean, do you think this is really going to work? Is there an opportunity for South Africa here? What do you think of this?
So beyond the symbolism and maybe seizing the moment, I guess one could give credit to the Chinese government for trying to seize on the optics of what's going on with high US tariffs being imposed. That apart, I'm not sure where exactly South Africa and other African countries are going to gain from a value add point of view. So what I mean by that is, it's great to have tariff-free trade on raw materials and commodities, for example, but what about value add manufacturing components, those sorts of goods where they add more value in the South African manufacturing sense? And those things, I mean, in the space of automotive, aluminium, steel, should they allow for the value add exports, that would mean some more competition in some places, not on volume, but maybe on quality for some domestic Chinese manufacturing of some of those goods, components, materials, etc. And would they really allow for that kind of thing? There's also already, there is in some areas with some African countries, there are preferential or indeed zero rated offers already on the table. So the question is, what would make this different for African countries to increase their export base to China, where it's so narrow at the moment, even with having some of those preferential rates in place? And then just the last point, if it's just about tariffs, that it's great if there's some rhetorical progress, but you also have to look at non-tariff barriers. So when I talk about that, let's talk about South African agricultural exports to China. Are there any non-tariff barriers on in terms of quality of produce, for example, that are punitive or that are so prohibitive that they just prevent exports for a sector that is so important for South Africa? So it depends a lot on, you know, we always say where the rubber hits the road on the implementation side. For now, I see it as an attempt to win on the optics side, but not necessarily China in the long term giving up real control. And then, sorry, just the very last point, what conditions or demands would this kind of tariff-free access come, if anything, in the long term? So China has done this in terms of infrastructure projects, investing in those ports, railways, bridges in African countries. And then when the day comes to pay, or when there's debt and the country or the government can't pay, they act accordingly. Could they then use this similarly, along with the Taiwan issue, to say, you know, if you cross certain red lines with us on our international geopolitical policy issues, then you lose elements of the so-called tariff-free access.
Terence, what do you make of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Chris makes a very important point, the non-tariff barriers. And this is how China has developed a lot of its competitive advantage, by doing things like currency manipulation. There's a part of me that doesn't really fault them for this. You know, you're going to do what you're going to do for your own advantage. And I don't think that this is altruistic, and nor should we expect it to be. That being said, let's assume, all things being equal, that this actually does represent a big market opening. It seems to me that they want the minerals anyway, so that is kind of what they would be taking in. The one area where Africa could probably make a bit of a splash is in agriculture. And I know that China has historically kept a lot of other countries' produce out. There's one of the big ironies, you know, African countries would complain about European and American protectionism, but wouldn't raise the same issues, even though China had exactly the same kind of barriers. South Africa, I think, could be an outlier, but I still think that the sort of structure of our costs, and you know, Chris will tell you about the logistics nightmare that sits astride any attempt to engage with the outside world, means that China, you know, is still just, you know, unassailable. But they would be able to sort of claim a kind of points victory, or more, you know, morale victory. So yes, you know, well, we're doing what we can. We can't fill in everything, but you know, we're not actively hurting you. And maybe this is a 1% help, but it's like not a 10% hurt. So yeah, you know,
I think part of Chinese strategy here is to woo Europe into developing stronger trade relations with China. And, you know, Europe has this sort of weird kind of paternalistic view towards a lot of Africa. And so in a sense, this may also be about trying to say to the Europeans, look, you know, we're all for the free trade and the good flow of goods and all that sort of thing. So look at how nice we're being to Africa. Come be our friends. I don't know, Terence, what do you make of that?
Yeah, look, China, China has competent diplomats. They are sort of careful and considered in what they do. You may not like where they're trying to take things, but at the start of the sort of tariff war, they reached out to the Europeans and said, no, well, you know, we've got to cooperate on this. And they also, I think, do have the ability to kind of split their hard geopolitics from their trade interests, at least to an extent. That's why, you know, you have a big economic relationship between India and China, but literally an armed standoff on their border. You know, the fact that we may go to war with two nuclear powers is no reason not to trade.
All right. Speaking of war between nuclear powers, let's go now to the big international news from the Middle East, and that is concerning conflict between Iran and Israel. So you may see analysts and headlines declare that Israel and Iran are at war now. That's not true for a number of reasons, and the main one is that they've sort of already kind of been at war for years now. Israel and Iran have been in a sort of grand geopolitical struggle over the Middle East for many, many years now. This has involved sort of almost active conflict between Israeli aircraft and Iranian troops or Iranian-backed troops in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq. The Iranians have had various proxy groups such as Hezbollah and the Houthis attack Israel, attack Saudi Arabia. And so this is not a new conflict by any means, but we are certainly seeing it enter, I think, a new phase. And that came with Israel's airstrikes on Iranian senior personnel and nuclear facilities last night. Israel has said that it opposes Iran's nuclear program and that Iran was extremely close to being able to develop a nuclear bomb, with some anonymous sources telling various media publications that the Iranians were simply days away from having enough enriched uranium to produce, I think the number given was 50 nuclear bombs. We don't know if that's true, but it certainly seems to be similar to what a lot of the sort of more public reporting has suggested. And with talks of a US-Iran deal of some sort, which might still allow uranium enrichment, or would only allow uranium enrichment to a certain percentage, or only allow uranium enrichment in a certain location, there may have been a fear in the Israeli government that they needed to strike now before the window closed. At the same time, Iran has also been developing more bomb-resistant facilities, knowing for a long time that Israel had plans to strike their nuclear program, and Israel may have thought that now was the time to hit those things before Iran completed them, allowing itself more protection. Interestingly, this Israeli strike appears to have had no assistance from the U.S. Well, maybe there was some intelligence sharing. Apparently, the Israelis told the U.S. of their intention to do this something like a week ago. The U.S. also sort of partially gave advanced warning to Iran by withdrawing a lot of its personnel from the Middle East, taking them out of harm's way, which I think everyone noticed as a real sign that something was about to kick off. But the Americans have said that they will defend Israel from Iranian missile attacks, and that Iran needs to make some sort of nuclear deal now to stop pursuing a nuclear weapon, or else, in the words of Donald Trump in his post on social media today, there will be nothing left. So a lot going on, kind of a complicated thing, long history here of these two countries conflicting with each other. Terrence, let me start with you. What do you make of this? Are we actually going to see some sort of resolution to this conflict? Is this just going to be another one of these little things where, I mean, you know, in the last year, Israel and Iran have actually already traded sort of airstrikes with each other, and it didn't turn into anything bigger. Where do you think things go to from here?
I think it all depends on whether Iran is actually able to get that bomb. Now, they said days away. Intelligence is not an exact science, so maybe they already have one. Was Israel able to take everything out? If not, then that bomb will still be there. Now, I think there's one of a number of things could happen. One option is that they actually do decide to use it on Israel. Maybe you can intercept it, but I'm sure that a detonation over Jordan or whatever would still not be a pleasant prospect. But I think more to the point is just the kind of blackmail. If Saudi Arabia normalizes with Israel, well, you know, would be a shame to see Riyadh covered by a mushroom cloud umbrella. And then, you know, what else happens? You have everyone else who can, like, racing to get a bomb so that they can, you know, have their own deterrence. These governments are not necessarily, it's in the most stable area of the world. Yeah. It's not a pleasant situation. My view is, unfortunately, this is kind of inevitable with the kind of state that Iran is. Now, this is not to give an unqualified endorsement to Israel or say that they're in all instances the good guys or whatever, but a state founded on, let's say, on very millenarian precepts is not likely to be, a country you can negotiate with. You know, Tehran is not Beijing, put it like that. Or Moscow in the 1980s. Someone once said, the Russians could always be counted on to act in their own interests.
Mm. Yeah, Iran, I think, is more akin to sort of the Soviet Union in 1919 or 1920 or something, when it still had these kind of dreams of global workers' revolution. Iran very much believes itself as leading a sort of Islamic revolution that will change the world. I think, Chris, you know, if you really want to trace the roots of this most recent exchange of hostilities, it goes back to Israel's war with Hezbollah in September of last year. Iran never needed necessarily to complete its nuclear weapons program, something that contains, you know, comes with a very high risk of getting people to attack you if you actually come very close to building those bombs. They could put it on the back burner because Iran had a deterrent against Israel, and that deterrent was Hezbollah. Hezbollah had this huge arsenal of rockets and this big militia that could cause huge problems for Israel, kill many people, cause lots of stress on the Israeli defense forces. And in September, beginning with that pager attack when the Israelis detonated Hezbollah pagers all over the country, killing and wounding lots of their leadership and operatives, and then followed up with a large number of targeted airstrikes, which were obviously informed by very good intelligence because they destroyed a huge number of Hezbollah rockets. Iran's ability to sort of press the button to tell Hezbollah to, you know, launch an attack on Israel, I think, disappeared. There's reporting now that apparently the Lebanese government is telling Hezbollah to stand down and not get involved in this, which is a very different dynamic to what existed in the past, where Lebanon's government didn't have much control over Hezbollah, which is a political party within the Lebanese government, but it's a part of a complicated coalition there. Anyway, and once that sort of deterrent from the Iran side disappeared, the Iranians had to rush for a nuclear weapon if they ever wanted to complete the program, because they now had no cards left to play against the Israelis, I think. And the Israelis perhaps fearing that window of opportunity for them to hit back on Iran might disappear, I think, is what led them to do this strike. What's your take on this? Do you agree with me? Do you think I'm right? What's your thoughts?
Far be it from me to disagree with you. So I won't wade into that territory just yet. On one of the sites that Israel hit, there has not yet been reported any sort of leakage. So that possibly tells you, not that they were inaccurate, but just to get to what they need to really take out, they will need the sort of equipment that the Americans can provide, those bunker buster missiles. That then it's up to the Trump administration whether they want to wade in, as it were, now, where Israel maybe tries to put the sort of onus on them. I did find it interesting that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he did his press conference in English. So noteworthy, I think, maybe in terms of the audience that he was really aiming towards versus what one might immediately think. So maybe Israel trying to put pressure on America to not forget their ties and to support them no matter what actions Israel now decides to take. Because I do think this will continue at this sort of level for the next 2 weeks or so. They will now try and use as in a shorter period as possible this momentum that they've seized. Because, Nick, as you rightly point out, who's really coming to Iran's aid? Should there be longer term, maybe a regime change in a positive sense in Iran, that does then in the bigger picture undercut Russian influence in the region and is yet another blow to their sort of global positioning. So it'll be interesting how that plays out, along with, of course, Russia being continually mired in the conflict in Ukraine.
So Terence, sort of final thoughts from you here. I mean, one of the big open questions here is exactly how much damage Israel is capable of doing to Iran. We know without the US's support. So far, we have seen, I think in the last couple of hours, Iran launched its first drone strike back on Israel. And the Jordanians assisted in shooting down some of those drones. So it does appear that this is a real problem for Iran, which is that Israel can fly over towards Iran without being shot down. But if Iran shoots anything back, some of Israel's neighbors, despite what they may publicly say, will help Israel defend itself, which I think is very useful to the Israeli side. But
they will certainly help against Iran.
Yes. It was very funny watching, I think, a statement from the Saudi Arabian Foreign Ministry condemning Israel's attack on the brotherly Islamic nation of Iran this morning, knowing well that Saudi air defenses will almost certainly assist Israel in shooting down missiles, or they may pass intelligence to the Israelis or something like that. I mean, the Middle East is filled with sort of doublespeak and hypocrisy. But anyway, you know, what happens if as you guys have kind of pointed out, you know, this Israel isn't able to do the job without America getting involved? Is America going to inevitably be drawn into this if it goes on long enough?
My sense of it is that Trump is just unpredictable. Who knows? You know, but I genuinely think that he would want to keep America distant, at least in terms of I don't think you're going to find American soldiers or airmen involved there. Perhaps you know, supplying equipment, but even there, I don't know. And that's the best answer I can give. I just don't know. I do think though that there are people in America's foreign affairs and defense bureaucracies who would say, you know, once you've rolled the dice on this, you've got to see it all the way through. You can't sort of inflict a vicious wound and then kind of walk away. It's been said, you know, the Iranians don't think in terms of a week or, you know, a project. They think in terms of world history. So, you know, 10, 15 years time, well, we're ready for a rematch. Horrible situation.
So, Chris, I had somewhat of an amateur theory, and you tell me if I'm drawing lines on a chalkboard that don't exist. But the Israeli operation here is being called, I think the code name is Rising Lion. And that suggested to me as being an interesting choice of words for a code name for this, which is that Iran's pre-Islamic revolutionary flag from the time when it was a monarchy featured very prominently in the middle a lion holding a sword. Do you think the Israeli government might be hoping that if they deal a heavy enough blow to the Iranian government, that there will be some sort of popular uprising against the Iranian government? There have been a number of such uprisings in recent years, but they've never been able to overcome the military strength of the Iranian state. Do you think there's any chance that Israel maybe thinks that if they just knock the Iranian mullahs hard enough that the Iranian regime will collapse?
Yeah, I think that would be under the medium to long-term hope, as it were. If you can hit the right levers or the right points to lead to that kind of momentum as Israel, then you would hope that in your calculations that sort of thing happens. There were some reports in the last 12 hours that many people were celebrating in Tehran specifically as to maybe now the possibility for some real change is happening. If you look at the precision of some of these strikes, I mean, just from a sort of intelligence point of view, it is quite remarkable how the goal was the leadership, wherever possible, of the regime and of the military and intelligence forces, and the nuclear facilities or nuclear linked facilities. No real goal for civilian casualties or that kind of impact from a military operation point of view. So I think it makes sense to say they're from Israel's point of view, they're trying to play that game. Just from a, I know that wasn't your question specifically, but from a sort of domestic politics point of view, the Netanyahu government has been wobbly at the best of times, if we can say that, over the last 2-3 years, maybe even a little bit longer. This again shores up that control that he specifically has and just does boost some of his standing in his own cabinet and in the country.
Anyway, we will watch. Expect oil prices to be quite high for the foreseeable future, as all of that instability, I think, will spook oil producers a bit. But anyway, thank you very much for listening today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will, of course, be back on Tuesday because we have a long weekend. I hope you all have a wonderful long weekend, and we shall see you then. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day. Bye-bye.